Hi there, folks. How's everyone doing? It's good to see so many motivated people out here on a sunny day to come see a good event at Blue Stockings. Thanks for being here tonight, y'all. My name is Lee, and I'm one of the events coordinators, and I'm a collective member here at Blue Stockings Bookstore. You probably already know, but Blue Stockings is a radical, feminist, and left political bookstore, cafe, activist center. It's a whole lot of things in this small space in downtown Manhattan that we work really hard to keep here. Blue Stockings really exists because of the support of the communities that surrounds us, be that the volunteers who choose to work here for free every week, or folks who come to events or put on events here, or folks who buy books here instead of at Barnes & Noble or on Amazon.com. And we appreciate all the support that folks are able to provide to keep this place running. All of our events are free and open to the public, and we do pass down a little donation bucket. We recommend $5 to just a donation. If you're able to give $5, that's greatly appreciated. If you're able to give $20, that's also greatly appreciated. If you can't put anything in that bucket, this bucket, you're absolutely welcome to be here. I'm going to pass this bucket around. And money in that bucket really does go towards helping us keep our lights on and our doors open and books on the shelves and all the good things that you want to see here. It also helps events be free for folks when they need to be. So thank you for what you can give. What else do I want to tell you? So I'm really excited about tonight's event, and I can tell by people, the buzz around the store, that other folks in the shop are too. Jack Halberstam really has an ability, I think, to tie high and low theory in a way that other folks don't. And I think that's really important to making queer theory accessible and important and relevant. So I'm super excited to have Jack here. And let me tell you a little bit more about Jack. Jack Halberstam is a professor of English, Gender Studies, and American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. Halberstam is the author of 4 books, including The Queer to Failure, which we have up front for y'all, and has another book coming out in September from Beacon Press titled Gaga Feminists: Sex, Gender, and the End of Normal. Please join me in giving a warm, warm welcome to Jack.
Thanks, Lee, and thank you all for coming out. I'm really excited to be here. Obviously, the book didn't just come out yesterday, and maybe even a few people have actually read it. So what I'm going to do is just try to provoke some conversations here among us about the meaning of failure, and why I'm saying that failure actually is queer and may have something to do with being queer or with queer community. We're sort of living at a time when we were never more aware of the difference between failure and success, and the politics that it produces and the disparities of wealth that are a result of our definitions of success and failure. So I want to draw our attention to some of the assumptions that are embedded in the way in which we think about success and failure, and make the argument that failure is a better place to be in many ways in a society that defines success so clearly in relationship to the accumulation of profit on the one hand and the sustaining of heteronormativity on the other. So that's the basic shape of what we're going to do. Lee mentioned that I'm somebody who likes to go between the so-called low and high theory. And I want to tell you a little bit about what I mean by low theory. And even thinking about it makes me remember the first time that I did anything in Blue Stockings Books, which was so many years ago, in I think 1999, when the Drag King book came out. That was one of those projects that I did as an academic for no real academic reason. Do you know what I mean? Just because it was something that was meaningful to me to document drag king cultures, communities, subcultures. And I did a little reading from the book with a band then called the Backdoor Boys, which probably no one but the front row remembers. Thank you, all right. And it was very exciting. And I feel like this is similarly an exciting time for different reasons, but you know, you all live in New York, so you're very well aware of the sort of popular movements that are springing up precisely because people do not agree with the way in which we've defined success in this country and have spoken very clearly and loudly against that particular model, okay? So I'm going to begin, the way that I'll do this is I'll just say a little bit about what I mean by low theory so that you can, you know, go home and do some low theory if you feel like it later or as you go. And then I'll give you my basic read on failure, and then I'll give you three little ways to fail in case people are like, how could I be a failure? What could I do? Some of us all know very well how to fail. So other people may need help, and I'm happy to give you some clues, some tips, and then afterwards we can talk more about it. So I started thinking about low theory, basically in the wake of, you know, high theory in the academy. I was very much trained at the time, I was a grad student at the time, of deconstruction and Lacanian psychoanalysis, and honestly got really sick of talking about things that didn't seem to have any relationship to reality, and also felt sort of elitist and excluded lots of folks from the conversation who were very interested in being intellectuals, but maybe didn't want to do it through the university, right? And that seems absolutely right, incredible to me. So I started writing about low theory, and it was interesting, actually. I gave a paper on low theory at a university in England, and boy, people were so mad with me, which is kind of the story of this book. Every time I did one of these things and people got mad, I thought, okay, this is a good thing. I'm going to keep going with this. And I basically was called anti-intellectual for trying to argue for something that might be more accessible. And I get that critique, and we do live in a moment of deep suspicion of the academic in particular, and certainly of the intellectual. But low theory is not designed to be an anti-intellectual position. It's designed to recognize that theorizing happens at many different levels at the same time. And that one of the things that particularly professors should be able to do is speak to many different people in many different ways, because that's actually what we do in the classroom. So there's no reason to then abandon that when we begin writing books. So low theory understands that there are some projects that require a higher degree of accessibility precisely because they have a political project of transformation in mind. And I think that low theory is a good way of thinking about a whole set of theoretical models that are dedicated to transformation as opposed to simply abstraction. Now, I'm by no means the only person to have suggested this, but the only other person who I've seen use this term low theory is actually one of the guys who became a big deal in the Occupy movement, Dave Graeber. And you may have, he wasn't a leader since there are no leaders, but he was certainly cited in the New York Times several times. And he's written quite a few books on anarchism. And he's asked the question, why in academia people are very drawn to Marxism, and there are entire schools of thought that are Marxist and leftist, but anarchism doesn't have that same kind of appeal, which is interesting, especially because it's such a punk and queer kind of politics. So he used this term in a little book called Fragments Towards an Anarchist Anthropology that I recommend to everybody. It's a very cool little book saying he doesn't want to hear people poo-poo anarchism as if it's not possible. And he gives examples around the world of lots of different places where people live in social organizations that are separate from the state, which is really the sort of technical meaning of anarchism. And this is what he has to say about something that he also calls low theory. He said, even more than high theory, what anarchism needs is what might be called low theory, a way of grappling with these real, immediate questions that emerge from a transformative project. And so you can hear that's very much the meaning of low theory that I will be using too. If you wonder about what happened to Dave Graeber, he wrote several books and then was denied tenure at Yale, which is probably to his credit, and allowed him to go on and, you know, do bigger and better things with the Occupy movement and in other places. But there are a few pointers that I'd give you about low theory. And my hope for low theory is that it's a kind of methodology that people can see themselves in relationship to without the benefit of an academic program to guide them. So the first rule is that you don't sacrifice complexity for plain speech, but nor do you dumb down needlessly, right? So you don't want to sacrifice complexity altogether, because in dumbing down, you often lose the kernel of the idea in the first place. So you have to find that sweet spot between the intellectually pointless and the intellectually totally obscure. Second, something I've already said, low theory is aimed at multiple audiences at the same time. There should be a versatility of address, that somebody would be engaged at the level of maybe an abstract notion, but also be able to break it down and hear it at the level of political pragmatic practicality. Third, Low Theory responds to what has become a big crisis in the academy around relevance. People really want to know, why should we pay academics to seemingly just sit around in their offices gossiping about other academics? Good question, good question. It's instead, there's a lot of what we do. No, it isn't. But there is a sort of, I think, a bit of pressure at the moment for people, particularly in the humanities, to say why what we do is necessary. And a lot of university administrators would like to just get rid of the humanities. So Low Theory is quite a necessary thing at this particular moment when people actually are being called upon to justify what they do. And of course, the right in this country believes that academics are all tenured radicals who are sitting around fomenting world revolution, which is also what we do. So they finally got something right. Low Theory has very strong and historical ties to feminism and queer theory, because both of feminism and queer theory came out of social movements. And therefore, we're always engaged with other communities, right? So that place where you try to find the relationship between a social movement and what happens in the university, I think that can be called low theory. In academic terms, or in intellectual terms, low theory is concerned with something that Michel Foucault called subjugated knowledge. And subjugated knowledge is a really interesting concept, because it doesn't mean knowledge that is pushed down or repressed simply. It means the knowledge that becomes unthinkable when something else becomes a science, right? So if something else becomes inevitable, like, oh, this must be true, then there are a whole set of other ideas that literally are impossible any longer to think. That is subjugated knowledge, and one has to figure out a way to access all of these other ways of thinking, because the way that we live in the world is by no means inevitable and is absolutely rigged and engineered for the benefit of a very few people. So one would want to think outside of those logics, and therefore, again, one would need access to something like low theory. Low theory recognizes that knowledge very much comes from below rather than above, so it's not handed down to people from the lofty perch of the university. It's something that people organize and create and imagine together. And low theory comes with a radical pedagogy, obviously. And again, a pedagogy that understands knowledge as something that passes and circulates, as opposed to something that comes from one person who's trained to other people who are not. Okay, so it's this sort of anti-elitist understanding of knowledge production. Okay, so that's low theory. So let me take my low theory to town a little bit here and start thinking through then some ideas about failure and success. And I'll just give you the basic tenets of the book, and then using my slides, we'll look at the three lessons in failure that I'm willing to share with you without you buying the book. Okay, for the others, you'd have to buy the book. And oh, you can't really see these, yeah, can you? Yeah. There were a couple of things that inspired me to write this book. First of all, I was invited by a lesbian art group, LTTR, that's still around in various incarnations, to speak at two events, one in New York and one in LA, and they were called Practice More Failure, and that was in 2004, some people may remember them. I was so inspired by this idea of thinking about failure as a practice, and I found this, I was looking up ideas about failure, and this was the first thing I came up with, was Quentin Crisp with this fantastic comment that if at first you don't succeed, failure may be your style. If at first you don't succeed, failure may be your style. And I think you can begin to hear the seeds of a queer notion of failure in that formulation, that failure might be a style. It might be a way of being. It might be a relationship to being and to doing and to living that runs counter to the ways that we have assumed as being normal, proper, and obvious. And then I don't know what happened to that one. That's a little iPad moment. But as I said, this is a good time to be thinking about failure, because we now are living in the ruins of a version of capitalism that has sold people success without warning people of the dangers of what happens if you don't succeed. So all of those bad mortgages, all of those, you know, those property booms and so on were part of a model of capitalism that promised people only the boom and never the bust, and sort of kept the bust hidden from sight. But what we all know very well anyway about capitalism is that capitalism is like gambling. It's like a casino model. You put money in, sometimes you get money out, but mostly the house gets money out and everybody else loses. So it's very important to recognize this moment of riots and protests as being created by a boom-bust economy that never wanted to actually grapple with the fact that in order for some people to win within a capitalist system, many, many, many people must lose. So the picture there is actually from the riots in France in 2005 that were sparked both by a crisis in the economy and by the sort of racist state in France. And they inspired a brilliant little book that was also very inspiring to me called The Coming Insurrection by the Invisible Committee. And one of the things that the Invisible Committee says about the economy is that the economy is not in crisis. The economy is the crisis. So the economy is always creating crises that then, guess what? The economy is the solution to. And you've all heard that, you know, that post 9/11, where there was a complete bust in the economic picture in the US, everyone was encouraged to go out and buy and shop, right? So the economy is always in crisis, and the economy always offers itself as a solution to crisis. And in the process, people are sold this model of success, home owning, making investments in shaky stocks and bonds, that never is, are we actually looking at the fine print and realizing that there will be a real price to be paid if your investments are not successful. And I think we all know that now, but I think it's worth reiterating. Okay, let's see what the next slide is. Just take it in for a minute. So one of the things that my book advocates is not simply a critique of capitalism, but a kind of refusal, that a refusal that does lie in some of the models that we have called anarchy. So a lot of what looks like failure, in fact, is refusal. And it's the kind of refusal that we saw in the Occupy movements, where people literally just arrived, took up space, and refused to move, refused to have a plan, refused to make demands, refused to organize themselves according to the political protocols of the mainstream, and instead just sat and said no. And failure, in a way, is very connected as a concept to this big idea of refusal, not small refusals, but big refusals that actually simply say no to the political organization of the world that we have had to settle for. Okay, so that was I'll get to my animated revolt in a minute. So that's the first frame of failure, if you like, is the economic frame, the one that we are all suffering the consequences of. But the queer idea of failure is, of course, that queers are schooled in failure, if you like. So when queer people grow up, they realize quickly, some queer people realize quickly, that they are going to fail to be the kind of men and women that the society is looking for. They might fail to reproduce, they may fail to do femininity in a certain way, they may fail to do masculinity, they may fail to want to get married, have babies, have a family, get divorced, retire, all the things that supposedly go along with heteronormativity. So one of the things that I say in the book is that queerness and failure go hand in hand, and rather than queers trying to be successful according to that model that I just outlined, queers have the tools and the intuition and the knowledge to offer up failure as an alternative, hence the queer art of failure. Then the third piece of this is that I wanted an archive of failure, an alternative archive that made failure look interesting, attractive, collective, beautiful. And for me, it was came to me in the form of these animated films for children. So let me just tell you about my passion for animated films. Now, as it turns out, there are people in our society who we allow to fail. Right? As an adult, failure is a really shameful, stigmatized kind of category. You might be out of work, or you might be queerly in your body, or you might not live up to certain social ideals, right? But when you're a child, you're actually allowed to fail. You have to be allowed to fail. I mean, moms and dads who only want their kids to succeed are, you know, tyrannical. We don't really believe in that. We believe in giving children the opportunity to fail often, to fail queerly, and to quote Samuel Beckett, to fail better. And so what happens is that a lot of the culture that is directed at children has to recognize them for the bumbling, stumbling, awkward little people that they are, and therefore these films are riddled with fabulous narratives about failure, about not being and not becoming and not succeeding and not triumphing. Because to triumph as a kid is like to be the bully or the obnoxious kid or a proto-fascist or something, right? So I started, when I was giving talks from some of the early versions of the book, I would use little examples from these animated films, and like, you know, Finding Nemo is such a brilliant little film. Remember Finding Nemo? He has a little disabled fin, and it's only when he swims away from his father, swims off into the big ocean and gets captured by the fishermen. You all grew up on Finding Nemo, right? Right?
Yes.
Blank looks, yes, okay. So as a kid, what he learns is the world is a big, dangerous place, and the only way to get by is to work with other people in a collective way. So in Finding Nemo, what happens through these narratives of failure is that the little animated creatures form collectivities that build other models of being that are not predicated upon conventional understandings of success. So in Finding Nemo, it's not that his father finds him in the end that is the, you know, the wonderful finale. It's that Nemo and the very queer bluefish, played by Ellen DeGeneres, Dory, remember, who can't remember anything, so she's clearly a failure in all kinds of ways, they band together and get all the fish to protest against the fishermen and swim down and escape the nets. Now that seems unusual, but actually every single one of these animated films reaches a climax with a moment of collective revolt, which is kind of extraordinary if you think about it. So in Robots, Rodney Coppertop goes to the robot metropolis to protest about the fact that the robot manufacturers are not making spare parts anymore for older models. It's like Mac, okay? If you think about Mac, Apple. They want you to own a computer for a year and throw it away and get the next one, right? So he has this kind of green mentality, and he goes and argues that we should be making parts for old robots, and he leads a robot revolt against Metropolis, and they do, in fact, begin to recycle. In Over the Hedge, the little suburban creatures who live in the environment with the suburbanites wake up after a long hibernation and find that the suburbanites have built a hedge between them and the animals. And they tear down this partition, this sort of border wall, tear it down and overrun suburbia together, all different species. Monsters, Inc., they refuse to extract screams from the kids to power the city and decide instead to go with laughter, which is kind of a sappy ending, but it still contains this really kind of intense critique of corporate greed. So this is kind of a remarkable thing, that in this archive dedicated to thinking about children and addressing children where they are, you get a combination of queer characters, anarchistic characters, and characters who are absolutely committed to collectivity. So that becomes a sort of weird, queer, quirky archive of the book that gives us our lessons in failure. Okay, so let me give you your three lessons, and this is the first lesson is don't be afraid to lose, or learn to lose, okay? And for this one, in terms of how to be a good failure, learn to lose, as I said, I began thinking about the project in around 2004, when there was, of course, an Olympic Games, as there will be this year. And in 2004, it was that year when, if you cast your mind back, you'll remember this, every time an American gymnast lost, he protested that the Russian judge had not given him fair marks. Do you remember this? And there were those annoying twins. Do you remember the twins? Yeah. I think they were gay twins. These sort of perfect Aryan gay twins who... which actually is a scene out of Dude, Where's My Car? And they were sure that they should have won, and they didn't win. But this was just kind of perfect for the way in which the U.S. Markets and televises the Olympics, because the way that the U.S. gives you sports events is only as something that the U.S. wins. So if you watch the Olympics and a weird event is on in prime time, it's because you already know that a U.S. person won it. Okay. Now, a really amazing thing like the 10,000 meters, which is one of the, you know, the premier races in the Olympic Games, will be on at 4 a.m. because an American will never win the 10,000 meters. It's going to be a Kenyan or an Ethiopian, and who cares about that? So that's 4 a.m., right? So I was really interested in the fact that the drama of sport is watered down via nationalism to this spectacle of winning, which in a way is one way that nationalism works. It sells you winning narratives over and over again, organized around this notion of collectivity that is the nation. But we all know from being involved in sports and watching sports that there is a beautiful drama that goes on around losing. So I did a little research and I found that Tracy Moffat, the queer Aboriginal photographer from Australia, had done her own project on the Sydney Olympic Games from 2000. So she heard through the grapevine that in Sydney, when the Olympic Games were on, the organizers were considering having her be the official photographer of the 2000 Olympic Games. And she was super excited. She thought, what will I do for this? This would be great. She thought, I know, I'm going to take pictures of people who lose. Okay? And so she first thought, I'm going to take pictures of people who win the silver medal because they've come so close, but they haven't quite made it. Then she thought, no, that's too good, because being the silver medalist is like being the second winner. So then she thought, the bronze medalist, that's really the medal you get for losing. And then she thought, no, because you still actually get a medal. And you're written in the history books, first, second, third. So she came up with fourth. And she took pictures of all of these athletes who came in fourth. And so they literally, in many of the shots, they stand just outside of the winner's circle in this sort of tragic gloom. What's more, she took the pictures from the TV. She didn't take the pictures live, which is why they have that grainy quality. So they're not even good photographs, right? So it's as if, like, you wouldn't use your best camera on the person who comes in fourth. You just take an after image, something from the TV. So she thought, this is fabulous. I've really captured, like, the gamut of what happens at the Olympic Games. She submits her idea, and of course Sydney was like, no thanks. And it was actually really hard to find this photo series, and it took me a long time to track it down to her gallery and even get permission to use it. It's one of those subjugated pieces that was just like lost as a concept. Fourth is a really great title as well, because of course it does refer to the fourth world of Indigenous peoples that Australia wanted to market as part of its multiculturalism at that Olympic Games, but we well know is actually part of its bloody history. And that's exactly what she's documenting, is a kind of colonial mentality within which, in order for the settlers to win, Indigenous people have to lose, right? Okay, your second lesson in losing and failing is be a lesbian, okay? And I say this with all sincerity in a lesbian bookstore. So let me explain to you how this works. You know, in a way, lesbians are the failures of the gay world, in a sense. There was no better illustration of this than the L word. And we all pretend we don't remember it and didn't watch it, but probably many people here, some of us watched the original series, many have watched in reruns. We've hated every minute, we've never missed an episode, etc. But what was so instructive about the L word was simply to see what had to happen in order for lesbians to go mainstream, right? Now, there are lots of instances on TV of gay men going mainstream, the queer eye for the straight guy being one. But there are many gay men on television telling people how to make clothing, right? Project Runway, telling people how to wear clothing, telling people how to be fabulous, use products, and so on. There are not very many lesbians doing that kind of thing. So the question was, how do you make lesbians fit for prime time? And the very clear and obvious answer was, you have to drop the butch. You have to. Now, you can have, you know, the Shane character, the hairdresser with the bad hair, who looks like a boy, sometimes is mistaken for a boy, dates straight women, but in the show itself, disowns the concept of butchness. Now, my point here is not to say, oh, the L word is a bad show because it's butchphobic. I'm not interested in that narrative. What I am interested in, however, is the fact that in order for lesbianism to make its way into the realm of capitalist viability, it has to lose the butch lesbian. Now, what that tells me is that the butch lesbian provides some sort of block to capital. That is really interesting, right? We're used to saying that nothing blocks capitalism. Capitalism can co-opt everything. If it's in the streets today, it's on a t-shirt tomorrow. If it's subculturally interesting, it'll be a mainstream sitcom, right? But actually, apparently, there is a formation that resists capitalism, and that formation is the butch lesbian. And here's an example, if you don't buy the L word piece of it, think of our friend Martina Navratilova, who is about to prove me wrong because she's apparently on Dancing with the Stars. You're clapping for that. I can't see Martina in a dress. It's just going to be painful. But Martina Navratilova is probably, certainly the most powerful women's tennis player ever. I think she's won more titles than anyone. I think she came back from semi-death to, you know, win the mixed doubles and get herself the last title that she needed. I mean, she literally is one of the most successful players of the game ever. She never had a meaningful commercial endorsement in her whole career, okay? Subaru, I don't consider that a meaningful endorsement. We already know it's a lesbian car. You don't need to have Martina sell it, right? And the rainbow Visa card. How long did that last? How many people are carrying a rainbow Visa card? So those were her endorsements when, you know, a 19-year-old blonde Russian lady who hasn't won anything yet is already a Nike sponsor. Do you see what I mean? So it's very clear in a lot of different realms that capitalism, which supposedly never met, an obstacle it couldn't run through, meets an obstacle in the butch. So failure, you see how failure can be turned to account for things that are resistant to capitalism on the one hand and are firmly rooted in the queer on the other. I think both of those examples allow you to see that. So that would be the second lesson. Okay. I'm not sure what's on my slideshow. So we'll keep going with this. So I have some great art in the book that develops this idea of lesbianism as a place of failure. And lots of people have written about this in academia with different kinds of success. So there's a book by Heather Love called Feeling Backward, in which she suggests that lesbianism is often cast as impossibly dowdy, as, you know, we talk about things like lesbian bed death, as if all long-term relationships don't have some relationship to bed death. Suddenly it becomes lesbian bed death. And everyone else whose long-term relationship wanes has lesbian bed death, right? So Heather Love suggests that we need this stereotype of the lesbian to symbolize the impossibility of love in general, okay? So I was looking for some artwork that did this, and I found these extraordinary portraits by a Los Angeles-based artist, Monica Maggioli, who did these Black Mirror paintings that I'll just tell you a little bit about. So Monica is a very exact painter, and she's done sort of orgy scenes in the past, beautiful oil paintings with bodies in all kinds of different poses. For these, she made portraits of her ex-lovers by taking their photograph as they were mirrored back in a black mirror. Okay, and the dark mirror is actually, it has a long, long history in painting. Dark mirror paintings go back to the Renaissance. You could think about somebody like Goya as an example. But she actually bought a house, that it promptly fell underwater, you know, as LA homes do. She bought a house simply because it had a dark mirror in the bedroom. Okay, she didn't matter what else was going on, had a dark mirror in the bedroom. She buys the house, she starts inviting her ex-girlfriends to come, and they have to pose for her naked in her bedroom, and she took their picture in the dark mirror and then painted it. Now, this is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, and the PowerPoint representation rendition cannot make sense of this darkness. But what she's doing is literally painting desire as darkness, as something that's impossible, as loss. I mean, these are not her lovers now. This is about the end of the relationship. Now, in the past, we would have been worried about representations like this because they would have represented lesbianism in a negative light. But if you go with my idea of failure as something that is specific to queerness, that queerness should cultivate, then you can see why one might want to actually give the shape of lesbianism to the impossibility of love and make an art out of it. Okay. And this is I think I'm not going to go into, this is a whole other chapter of the book, but this is a local photographer, New York-based photographer, Collier Shaw, who similarly looks at these very dark histories of gays and lesbians and makes portraits out of them. So Collier went to Germany as, I don't know, on visits really, over a series of summers, and took pictures of young men in uniforms. And I use these pictures that he took, and some of them he dressed up in, actually, in, as you see, in SS uniforms. And I use his pictures to try to make sense of a very dark chapter in gay and lesbian history, within which I try to unpack the mythology of the relationship between Nazism and homosexuality. And just as in the relationship to the lesbianism, I don't refute the idea that impossibility and lesbianism might have something to do with each other. Similarly, rather than resisting the idea that Nazism and homosexuality might have something to do with each other, I argue that we have to be willing to tell these more complicated histories that run through failure, loss, lack, you know, horrifying kinds of political struggle, in order to have a more complex understanding of what it means to be gay or lesbian in any given historical period.
All right. Just think about that for a minute, and okay, we don't go further.
All right. I'm going to end, however, by, well, maybe I will end with Babs. Yes. Okay. So, My last lesson in losing, then, is to always think outside of the options that have been given to you. And that's the way in which I'm trying to conceive of failure, is outside of the logic of success and failure, and outside of the logic of capitalism, and outside of the logic of a gay and lesbian history that simply has to be unearthed from the past. And my heroine for thinking outside of the choices that have been given to you is Babs from Chicken Run. Now, if you think back to Chicken Run, you'll realize quickly that Chicken Run was a sort of animated fable of feminist revolt, right? You thinking about it? It's a great claymation film made about chickens who are stuck in a chicken farm that is run by the unscrupulous Mr. and Mrs. Tweedy, who are basically the paragons of capitalism, in that they exploit the labor of the chickens, they take their eggs and they use them, and then they decide to make the chickens into chicken pot pies, at which point the chickens realize, we've got to get out of here. So it's one of those animated films that I was talking about, within which the animals queerly gang together in a kind of collective way and organize themselves to revolt. But there are three feminists in this narrative, and I want to tell you why we should get behind Babs as our failure feminist, okay? So there are three feminists. One is Ginger. Ginger's the kind of liberal feminist who says, we've got to get out of here, girls. We've got to do something. She's rallying everyone, organizing everyone. But she's also suspicious because she's in a romance with Mel Gibson, of all people, okay? Then there's Bunty, who's another kind of feminist, who's a cynic, who says no to everything. No matter what political plan Ginger comes up with, Bunty says, no, it's not going to work. Forget it, ducks. It's not going to work. That's what she says, ducks. It's a bird joke. And then finally, there's Babs. So in one very inspirational speech, Ginger says, girls, we're going to die free or die trying. At which point, Babs, who's knitting at the time, says, are those the only options? And so while she doesn't seem like the most inspiring of the three, she is actually our failure feminist. And she represents that politics of refusal that you saw in the little Anarchy comic, but it comes up in every animated film as a way of opting out of the political terrain that's been offered to you, and thinking queerly about living otherwise in the world. Thank you. So I'm happy to have either questions or comments or thoughts, other animated plot summaries. Yes.
Can you go through again the methodology of low theory?
Really?
No, but I can definitely, you know, sort of encapsulate it for you. In the academy, people talk about high theory, and high theory is like, it's a very specialized language, and it generally often involves psychoanalysis or deconstructive methods. It's really about the slipperiness of language and signification, and it tends to be kind of an inside game that people use to think complicated thoughts. And to, I guess, you know, to theorize about meaning. And that's great, that's all well and good, but I'm just trying to use low theory to say there are other things that we can use theory for, and there are other ways of theorizing, even though in the academy we don't always recognize them. So a low theory is exactly that. It's theory that wants to work at a lower level of abstraction in order to address a larger number of people. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments? Yeah.
You mentioned colonialism in several different realms during the talk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those non-academics who love crashing academic conferences because it's always exciting to see what they're thinking about or trying to think about. And I actually addressed a group of gender studies people once, and because it was a fascinating weekend of stuff, and I said, how do you comment about, you know, academia making things real, like going out and sending out the masses to colonize and create and exploit the riches of society, and then you make it real, you create these beautiful jewels that then you sell to create a place in it, and none of the academics wanted to touch that, and I was like, what did I say wrong, you know?
Well, I think it's the way you're using colonize.
Yeah.
Okay, because when I'm saying colonize, I'm talking about, you know, let's say in relationship to Tracy Moffat's work, I'm talking about an indigenous photographer who's trying to draw attention to the dynamics of settler colonialism, right? Australian white people who come and say, oh, this land's empty, we'll go here, right? So, but you seem to be using colonize to say, oh, once we have, you know, radicalized people, we should send them out to colonize something, as if that would be a good thing.
Well, I was critiquing this because they were sending all with culture studies and things. They have to go out there and then they bring it into the academy. They articulate it and then they discover these things. Like
the same way as
Columbus discovered the Americas.
Yeah, yeah.
You are going out and making it real for whom?
Right.
For yourselves.
Right.
And
right. Right.
Power structures.
Yeah.
And not giving it back to us who are non-academics.
See, and I just right. Okay. Thank you. So I would like to get rid of that us-them thing, because particularly in queer studies, a lot of people who are in you know, the university doing queer work are not only in the university, and a lot of people who are not in the university doing queer theorizing, you know, are not only outside of the university. The boundaries are actually a bit more permeable than we think. There are definitely, I mean, I realized, like, I thought I had written a book that was more accessible, but then people, you know, write on a review or something. There was a review of it in Bitch magazine that was like, oh, Halberstam thinks this is accessible, but let me warn you, you're going to be wading through some heavy stuff that you're not going to want to read, basically. And then you realize, yeah, you know, what we think is accessible from too long reading this particular kind of writing just doesn't translate. But you're right. There is a kind of colonial relationship between the academic and areas of knowledge and this idea that one owns something and now knows about it and then sells it back to people is really troubling. And that's exactly why one would want to come up with these other models of learning, knowing, speaking, communicating. Yeah.
Just so you know, I really appreciate this whole life of failure, because I've been calling myself a sustainable failure for over 10 years. And it's been really troubling, because it's like, what are you doing? What are you guys? It's like,
yeah.
I don't want to be a success in your world.
And the ones
who try to force me to get a job or go back to college
right.
so I can get some props, it's like, that has nothing to do with the work I want to do in the world. And so, you know, like, and this whole co-optation of sustainability over the last 10 years of like, what does that mean? It's like, oh no, sustainable now becomes something to profit off of
right.
and not actually address the needs and desires of all of us.
See, that's perfect. I mean, you sort of framed beautifully this idea of failure as actually things that people do for as their life that may not be recognizable if the only thing that one thinks about is success is, you know, high level professionalism or something, right? So there are lots of people who have made their lives separate from these standards of professional success. That's exactly it. And in fact, those people may be making more of a contribution in the end than a bunch of lawyers, for example. Certainly than a bunch of academics, but then they don't claim to make a contribution. So, yeah.
I have a question. I think you said that the butch lesbian resists capitalism. And I get how, in the context that you're describing, like the identity or the perception of the butch lesbian confounds capitalism.
Right.
But that's more about sort of a confoundment of the system as an agent of recognition, as opposed to necessarily a choice of the individual as an agent.
No, it's not about an individual.
I'm curious about whether you would make the statement that the femme dyke is a confoundment.
Yeah, no.
And further, I feel like when I hear that statement, I wonder about how it reinforces the butch dyke as the zenith of queerness for queer women?
Fair enough. Okay, so that's a really good question. So let me answer those three pieces. One, no. This is not about, oh, you know, butchers all fail and they all try to fail, and then when they try to fail, they're fabulous at it. You know, it's not an agency thing, and it's not another badge of honor. It's more like trying to get outside of, you know, even my own work on female masculinity, that is quite invested in this heroic figure who can't be reckoned with and is left outside and needs to be brought in. And, you know, and I stand by that. But I realize there are other things to say about this figure that are more helpful. For example, that symbolically speaking, capitalism seems not to want to run through that particular body. So you can see two feminine bodies doing things together in beer commercials all over the screens. You know, like, there are beer commercials love feminine women wrestling around. There's mud wrestling or whatever. But very few commercials, even the ones that want to go to an extreme and use a transvestite figure or something, very few of these kinds of commercials want to use the figure of the butch. That's part of what I'm saying. Now, I don't think that should now set up a new level of queerness, is the failure to conduct capitalism, therefore the butch wins again, and we're in this sort of competitive struggle or something. Is that the femme's relationship to capitalism is different, because femininity has a different relationship to capitalism. You know, masculinity and capitalism are not always lined up, because masculinity is not supposed to be something you buy, it's something you are. Femininity is something you buy, okay? Femininity is a kind of luxury consumer good. So you produce it, you wear it, you are it, but it has a kind of luxury quality. So, and I'm not saying that about the femme, I'm saying femininity and masculinity are different, okay? So I think that, you know, one would want to make a different kind of argument about the femme. The femme is an obstacle to the free flow of heterosexual male desire. Because here's a body that the masculine heterosexual man is interested in, but she's not interested in him. Now, that rarely happens, that the gaze is not returned to the heterosexual male. And the fact that the femme doesn't return the gaze becomes another kind of problem. Okay, so I think I'm arguing for these kind of structural ways of thinking about butch femme, as opposed to identitarian. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yes.
I mean, I'm someone who's been interested in writing a lot recently, and I'm wondering, and I started reading your book a few months ago, and I'm wondering how failure, and like queer failure in particular, could be incorporated into a writing process in which we like fail upon ideas. Like we try, you know, we start somewhere and we have all these things that we want to write about, and then we stumble upon other ideas, or like erasure becomes part of the process. How do we contend with that, like that practical, like sort of process where failure is really emphasized in the writing, and what is actually published in the end? Like, I'm just trying to think about how you're navigating that, for example.
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question exactly. It's interesting. I did a little reading in San Francisco, and Michelle T asked me a question about writing. And, you know, again, I did self-consciously try to write differently in this book. But the next book that I'm putting out, the Gaga Feminism book, I really, like, I think it is a popular book. We'll see. I'm probably completely mistaken. But it's interesting when you're trained to write one way to try to write another. How it's interesting how stuck you get, you know, with needing to make a citation, for example, that to verify something, or a turn of phrase that would be very foreign to people who aren't reading discourse analysis, but you feel you have to say it that way to sound smart, you know, something like that. But there's another piece of that that is about the way any creative process runs through failure, you know, and yet we've been so unwilling to have these robust relationships to failure. I mean, that's what I hear you saying. Oh, even in writing, you have to discard 15 drafts before you get to one you like. You could say the same thing politically. You could say that, you know, just because movements in the past didn't succeed doesn't mean that they weren't absolutely crucial. And this is a point that Robin Kelly makes in Freedom Dreams. He says that there are legacies of failed movements that live on in the movements of the contemporary moment, and they at least leave what he calls a legacy of possibility, that people in another moment struggled. Whether or not they were successful doesn't matter. What's important to people now is to see that other people tried something. And I know when we look back on certain movements, we're not looking for success, because success often actually means becoming the status quo. And so that's why we are more interested in the failures, and we are more instructed by them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For people who are still in academia or within the academy, particularly in the humanities, mm-hmm. I guess, how would you say the best way to kind of approach academic work? I come from history, so
right.
To approach, say, historical work with an eye towards this model of successful or this model of failure.
Well, you know, particularly in the first chapter, I have a lot to say about academia, because it's so frustrating, actually, to be in the university in this day and age, to be honest with you. Partly because the university, more than a lot of institutions, is very slow to change. And yet we live in a world that doesn't resemble the world that produced the university as is. Do you know? So when people, the university that we have now is modeled on a university that came to be 100-200 years ago. And at that time, the meaning of these disciplines, like history, was something very different. And history would have been a national discourse. How did we come to be this nation? In which way, right? And English Lit was a completely different enterprise. English Lit was there to try to make sure that people who were newly enfranchised to vote became educated enough to make good decisions. And so literature was taken out to working people to educate them. So these disciplines had different purposes, but we still hold on to them, stupidly really, when the knowledge base has changed completely. And so this book is an argument not for interdisciplinarity, but for anti-disciplinarity, for unbinding knowledge from these rules and regulations that make certain that you only produce the kind of knowledge that serves the status quo or serves the national project, rather than the kind of knowledge that might bring it down. So when you read in the paper that, oh, economists didn't see this collapse of the economy coming. Really?
Yeah.
You're an economist, you didn't see this coming. I mean, I saw it coming, my God. Anyone who wasn't an economist saw it coming, right? So only an economist wouldn't see it coming, in fact, because that's the training. The training is build, 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 invest, 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 pay, pay, pay. Well, never think about collapse. So the point is that sometimes only from outside of the discipline can people see the questions that need to be asked. So I'm not a historian, but my little chapter on history in this book is about a chapter that no historian probably wants to go and touch, the history of the intertwining of homosexuality and Nazism that has just been cast as a homophobic myth, but actually does have some reality. Now, for a historian, that's not a great topic. But for somebody who's outside of history, it's fascinating, right? So I argue for being sort of a perpetual outsider to the organization of knowledge rather than the insider who therefore has been so well instructed that all you can do is produce a thing that confirms that your advisor was right. You know, mm-hmm. So I think the trick is to actually, if you wanted practical advice, is to look for interdisciplinary programs, not to go into disciplines, because disciplines want you to prove that that is the right way to do things. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you can't do it, you then can't get hired. Yeah. Not a happy message. Yes.
I am a medical student, and as you were talking about low theory, I kept drawing analogies in my head between sort of post-structuralist high theory and medical knowledge.
All right.
Because there are, as doctors, we use a lot of words, speak almost exclusively in words that like people don't know. And sometimes we do that because the word we're using refers to a concept that lay people don't use, like, let's say, demyelination, the loss of the insulation from a nerve fiber. But a lot of the time, it's... we use a Latin-derived big word for things that have perfectly serviceable regular English words. Like, we don't listen to the patient's heart, we auscultate it.
Uh-huh.
Or doctors have come up with...
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Have come up with polysyllabic Latin substitutes for just about every color of the rainbow.
Right.
You know, that's for red, and bilious for green, dictoric for yellow, eschar for black.
So it's a scientific language that...
Well, it's... It's, but it's not justified in terms of any scientific value.
Right.
There's an informal saying, say it in Latin and you can charge more.
I remember that.
And I've actually been reprimanded in the past for not doing that.
Uh-huh.
That there was a practice exercise where we had to interview a patient and they were complaining of symptoms that suggested they could have a kidney infection. And if you suspect a kidney infection, you're supposed to take your hand like this and pound on the patient's back over their kidneys and see if it hurts. And at the end, I said, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to pound on the patient's kidneys. And they said, we can't call it that. You have to say, assess for costovertebral angle tenderness. Or turn into an even more opaque acronym and say CBA tenderness. And it's sort of a way of
walling off
the knowledge of the discipline and keeping outsiders outside. And like justifying...
The training, the fee.
The income of doctors.
Exactly.
I would ask you, do you think that the difficulty of when I tried to read, say, Judith Butler,
mm-hmm.
that is serving a similar function of like justifying tenure or specialization?
I think when you read some things, I'm not going to say Judith Butler necessarily, because I actually think that Butler is somebody who, she has written some very dense books and she's written some very lucid books, and she actually is one of the bona fide public intellectuals of her time, and there aren't very many people at her level who do that, but there are shelves and shelves of books that do exactly what you're suggesting. But that's also part of professionalization, as you say, because then it confirms that only this person can make this diagnosis and explain what might be wrong, whereas there might be lots of vernacular folk ways of coming to the same conclusion. And it reminds me of a project that Dean Spade began actually in New York with the Sylvia Rivera law project for transgender people. And one of the things that he did with this nonprofit was he defied the logic of the nonprofit. And the logic of the nonprofit is that it's a nonprofit, but you still have hierarchical pay scale. So the lawyers have to be paid a lot, and the janitors have to be paid a little. And he refused to conform to that pay scale, and he wanted the lawyers to be paid the same as the janitors. And of course, the lawyers aren't going to agree to that. So the way that he got around it was by making sure that there were lawyers who would consult with people who were not lawyers but could attend a trial with somebody and give them the legal language that they may need without having to charge them. Do you see? So actually, what was so brilliant about that was showing that even though there are professional channels that we are supposed to use for all kinds of things, we actually go around these professional routes all the time. And to formalize that a little bit can be... have an incredible impact on the fact that somebody might actually get legal representation who absolutely could not otherwise afford it, for example. Or somebody could get some medical advice who could not afford to go to a doctor who doesn't have insurance. So yes, I think that there's a relationship between these subterranean routes to knowledge, you know, that don't go through the professional, and the kind of, you know, outline of the intellectual that I'm providing. So, thanks. Everyone feel equipped to fail? Good. Good. All right. Well, good.